We'll hear argument next in 04-1324, Day versus McDonough. Mr. Busby.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the State does not dispute that it waived the affirmative defense of limitations by failing to raise it in the District Court and by conceding in its answer that Day's petition was timely. Yet nearly a year into the case, after the parties had briefed the merits, the magistrate judge not only raised an argument that the petition was untimely, he actually imposed the State's limitations defense and dismissed the case despite the State's procedural default and contrary concession. That was error for two reasons. First, it violates the general principle of the adversary system and the civil rules that it's error to impose a forfeited limitations defense sua sponte, and the statutory text and rules have confirmed that this principle applies to habeas. Second, the State's concession of timeliness based on full information was an express binding waiver, and it was error for the District Court to override that concession.
It was a computation error. Is it not? This is not a case where the State chose to waive the statute of limitation. It miscalculated. Isn't that the case?
Well, there was a one-day miscalculation, Justice Ginsburg, on the 352 versus 353 days before that Mr. Day filed his post-conviction petition. But there's a legal dispute as to whether the days after between the time whether the
but we're not and we didn't take cert to decide if this claim was timely. We are on the assumption that it was untimely, but and what are the consequences of the State's failing to raise that?
Well, our position is that by expressly conceding in their petition that it was timely, that that's an express waiver. I mean, they say that they would have what they would have had to say was, we know we have a limitations defense. We're expressly giving that up, that the proper standard is the intentional relinquishment
but
of a known right.
The whole basis was the number of days that they calculated, and the magistrate said, oh, they miscalculated, there were more days involved.
Yes, under 11th Circuit law, the magistrate said they should have counted that additional time at the end.
Yes.
But this Court has said that the standard for express waiver varies depending on the right at stake. It's not always intentional relinquishment of a known right as it is with some constitutional rights. In fact, there are several courts of appeals that have said when you affirmatively plead the opposite of an affirmative defense, as they did here by saying it's timely, that that's enough for an express waiver.
And this suppose, court, suppose the magistrate judge had said, I noticed this error in accordance with 11th Circuit law, so I am going to suggest to the State that they amend their answer. The State certainly could, under Rule 15, the federal rules apply, the State could have amended its answer and done just what the magistrate judge did.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, they could have moved to amend their answer. We would have opposed it and would on remand if the issue were to come up on the ground that they had full information and so that this is not an appropriate case to amend an answer. But I agree with you that would have been one option, and that's the way that the Third Circuit analyzes this issue in the Long case and in the Bindolf case, using the principles of Rule 15. The 11th Circuit did not do that here. It said that there was an obligation for the court to impose the limitations defense. It did not apply the Rule 15 analysis.
Did it say an obligation or that the court could? It didn't. I didn't think it said the court must.
It did say, Your Honor, that there was an obligation for the court to impose it to further comity, finality, and federalism, and that can be found on page 5A of the appendix to the petition. A federal court that sits in collateral review has an obligation to enforce the federal statute of limitations. And in fact, they quote the advisory committee notes to Rule 4 saying the court has the duty to screen out. And they also expressly distinguished their precedent in Esslinger versus Davis, which relied on Granberry versus Greer to say it was a discretionary analysis. They said, we're not going to consider the discretionary issues raised in Esslinger and Granberry, whether this dismissal would serve an important federal interest. We're just going to say there's an obligation to impose this and that the district.
I see you're referring to page 4A.
5A, Your Honor.
Yeah, where is the sentence that says that?
The obligation is seven lines from the bottom, And it's that last paragraph where they're distinguishing Esslinger, and the sentence of the previous paragraph is where they say there's a duty.
I thought that duty is in connection with Rule 4.
Yes, Your Honor, and then they rely on that duty to say that there's an obligation in the next paragraph and to distinguish Esslinger and say we don't have to go through this discretionary analysis because there's an obligation. And so our position is that even
it's right that there's an obligation if it notices it in the first instance on its first review.
Well, we don't necessarily agree, Your Honor. We don't necessarily agree that
suppose under the review proceedings that the district court is looking at it for the first time without yet having required a response and he sees a statute of limitation, but I assume there's an obligation.
Under Rule 4?
Sure.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at what
you
Rule 4—
I mean, suppose it's an open and shut violation of the statute of limitations or barred by the statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. Does district court have discretion to refer to the state for a response?
Yes, Your Honor. We would say that,
really?
That they must do that because, as this court recognized in Plyler versus Ford, it's almost never apparent on the face of the petition that
my hypothetical is that it is.
Okay. I would think that even if it were apparent on the face of the petition that the Rule 4 has two parts, and the first part of it, the non-adversary screening function, only applies when the petitioner is plainly not entitled to relief. And I think the better view of that clause is, although there are some arguments in our brief that don't take this view, after having given it thought, I think the better view of that clause is that it does not apply to an affirmative defense that's subject to waiver or tolling, that you can't say based on an affirmative defense that's subject to waiver or tolling that someone is plainly not entitled to relief. You could say, for example—
Because the other side might make a mistake and not recognize it?
Or it might be told, Your Honor. And there are also four different trigger dates in the statute for when it can first apply that you aren't going to be able to tell necessarily three of them from the face of the petition.
Or the other side may say, although technically the statute of limitations applied here, taking all considerations into account, we think that this prisoner acted with reasonable promptness, and perhaps the delay was somewhat attributable to the state. Do you think that that's a proper consideration?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The statute of limitations in AEDPA is designed to prevent delay, not to, as Congress has said, it's not a forfeiture provision. It's designed to move these complaints along speedily, particularly in capital cases, of which this is not one.
But it could be argued that the federal government wants to move them along speedily, whether or not the state government wants to.
Certainly, and there are concerns.
So that would suggest that the state's voluntary waiver of a statute of limitations should not make any difference. It's a federal interest involved, not a state interest.
Well, there is an interest in judicial efficiency that's at issue here, too, but we submit that it's far more inefficient for the court to put limitations under this first category of Rule 4 and say that the court must, on its own, look at limitations every time without assistance from the parties than it is to make the state do its job. I mean, they're the ones, recognized.
We could agree with you that there isn't an obligation on the federal judge to raise it. But the question is, you know, it could be a must, it can be may not, or it could be may.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why shouldn't we treat this as a may? Judge noticed the clerical error and called it to the party's attention by an order to show cause.
Well, the proper procedure under Rule 4 is not to call it to the party's attention in that way.
It's past Rule 4 because an answer has been ordered.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, and it's only when the answer comes in that this issue is spotted.
Yes, that's correct. And I agree with you that the proper procedure after that would be to bring the issue to the party's attention and let the state decide whether it wanted to file a motion to amend under Rule 15. And if it did so, there are very clear standards that are applied that were not applied in this case to decide.
There are very what standards?
There are very clear standards,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Leave shall be freely given.
Yes, but there are also — it's a discretion — again, it's a discretionary determination, and there are prejudice issues that should be considered as
the — What would be the prejudice that could be claimed by the habeas petitioner?
Well, the prejudice in this case is that the standards of Rule 15 were not considered. But in addition, there are well-recognized decisions both from this court and from the courts of appeals that says a judge may deny leave to amend when at the time the concession is made in the answer, the state had full information. And the state admits here that it had all the information it needed to make the limitations calculation attached to its answer in which it conceded timeliness, but then waited a year or several months to bring it up later. And so we would argue, if this were a Rule 15 analysis, that it would not be appropriate for the court to allow the amendment.
Are you saying that the error is simply that it wasn't done via Rule 15? What if we were to say that the same considerations apply when it's simply raised sua sponte by the district court? What would be your objection to that?
Well, that would be that's the respondent's position. And I think in addition to those considerations, if you disagree that this is a forfeiture and you disagree this is an express waiver, and you get to their position that this is a discretionary test and you should just apply the same Rule 15 factors, I think you need to also apply a presumption against sua sponte consideration. There's one way to do it under Rule 4, and that's the most efficient way. It's also the way that comports with judicial neutrality in the adversary system. And so to encourage
people — But you couldn't do this under Rule 4 because, as you, I think, recognize that just from that petition, from the habeas petition, you couldn't tell.
I'm sorry, Justice Ginsburg, I misspoke. I meant to say Rule 15. But if to encourage parties to do this under Rule 15, the court should adopt a presumption against sua sponte consideration. And this in Arizona versus California, which they rely on heavily, they say that this type of consideration should be reserved for rare circumstances. And we cite several cases in our brief where that also support that proposition. So we would submit, if you do get to this analysis, Justice Alito, that there should also be a presumption involved.
Well, if you think it's done under Rule 15, would the considerations necessarily be exactly the same in a habeas case as in an ordinary civil case?
Not necessarily. But we do submit that the timing issue that we just raised about them having full information would certainly be something we'd argue to the district court in its discretion. But another thing you have to consider, to your point, is that limitations is something that has a subtle meaning and derived and is directly addressed by Civil Rules 8 and 12. And this court in Gonzales and Mail says that when that happens, that's where you start with the civil rules, and then you ask if there's anything in the habeas statutes or rules that's inconsistent with that approach, with the forfeiture approach of the civil rules.
Yes, but the civil rules allow for amendment.
Yes, Your Honor.
8C and there's 12B, but there's also 15.
Yes, I agree, and that was not used in this case. We agree that would be an appropriate way to raise this.
It seems the height of technicality to say that the judge could suggest now, State, I will entertain a motion to amend the answer under Rule 15, instead of saying, I'm issuing an order to show cause why this action is not out of time.
Well, I don't agree, Your Honor, because there's a specific analysis that goes along with Rule 15 that wasn't applied here. But in addition to that, there's an efficiency interest to be served by having the state calculate and make the motion rather than putting the burden on the federal court to do it. The court, we submit, should make the state — this court in Plyler said the state's in the best position to make the limitations calculation. It's an error-prone, fact-intensive, burdensome calculation, and they shouldn't be allowed to foist that burden on the court. The court should make them do their job. And so our position is that's the reason that it should be done under Rule 15. It also doesn't put the state in the position of being an advocate it doesn't put the court in the position of being an advocate for the state and having the court directly across the bench from the petitioner, not involving the state, saying, I'm developing some arguments on behalf of the state now why this is untimely. What do you have to say about it?
Why does proceeding under 15 does not do that, whereas proceeding this way does?
Well, proceeding under 15, you would say to the state, do you want to make a motion to amend?
Wink, wink.
Well, but, I mean, there is some value in that, I think, particularly where the state has expressly conceded timeliness. I mean, the magistrate judge in this case, all he had before him was the express concession from the state. The state never said anything in the district court even after he issued his notice to the petitioner to show cause why it wasn't untimely. So the magistrate judge, all he had before him was the state's position that it was timely.
Isn't that concern present in Granberry as well? And yet the court reached the opposite result there.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in Granberry the state raised the issue for the first time on appeal. The court did not. So there you do have the adversary system at work. In addition, Granberry is different for several other reasons. Exhaustion is, unlike limitations, unique to habeas corpus. It's not covered by Rule 8. And also, it's a common law limit that this court has developed on habeas relief. It's not a statutory affirmative defense. And as our brief points out, Congress has treated these very differently when it codified them in AEDPA. And this applies not only to exhaustion, but non-retroactivity, abuse of the writ, and procedural default. I'm sorry, procedural default was not codified. But the other defenses, the other limits on habeas relief that the petitioner relies on were codified very differently in AEDPA, whereas for exhaustion, it says relief shall not be granted unless you exhaust. That's a substantive limit on relief. For limitations, however, it says when you're —
One that requires the court to raise it sua sponte, even if it's not raised by the state.
I beg your pardon?
One that requires the court to raise it sua sponte, even if not raised by the state, correct?
Potentially, yes, if you codify it as a substantive limit on relief. Whereas limitations is simply codified, it says a period of limitation shall apply. It doesn't say relief shall not be granted unless you file within 1 year. It doesn't even say, as it does in the capital context, for certain — for capital opt-in states, that it must be filed by a certain time. It just says a period of limitation, and that has a settled meaning that goes along with it.
Your position is it should be like any other civil case.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can raise it sua sponte. We've said in exceptional circumstances.
Yeah.
I don't know what they are.
Well,
the judge could say, you know, I'm surprised that you haven't raised statute of limitations.
Hmm?
And then the lawyer for the state says, oh, my goodness, quite right, we'd like to amend.
Certainly. And there are good reasons to amend. Yeah. For example, the Bindolf case that you have before you, there was an alteration in a date, and the Third Circuit didn't ascribe that to any particular person. But nonetheless, the documents that the state had before it had the wrong date on it from which to calculate.
Must there be good reasons for the judge to say, quote, I'm surprised that you haven't raised a statute of limitations defense? Must there be good reason for that? And if not, aren't you asking us to waste our time?
I don't think
Why don't you do it the easier way? Then, yeah.
I don't think so, Your Honor. If you put limitations as something that the judge must raise, I think you're asking the judge to waste his time rather than leaving it to the parties
What's your answer as to whether there is any limitation on the judge just suggesting, by the way, is there some reason why you haven't pleaded statute of limitations? Can a judge do that?
Well, I would think that it would be evaluated under an abuse of discretion standard, and I haven't given much.
When would it be an abuse of discretion
for a judge to invite the state to amend?
Right.
I would say if it would be in this case, perhaps because of the state's express concession to the contrary. And so that might be one circumstance. But I don't think this court needs to circumscribe.
It wouldn't be an abuse of discretion for him to suggest an amendment if he's got the opportunity to rule on the amendment later on, and then presumably the ruling would be reviewed for abuse of discretion.
That's a good point, Your Honor. I don't think this court needs to circumscribe the judge's authority to suggest an amendment. I think you could wrap it all into the ruling and evaluate that for abuse of discretion.
I suppose it might be an abuse of discretion if you'd already had a hearing and decided that there was merit to the plaintiff's claim and then decide, well, now I'm going to throw it out on limitations. Might be an abuse of discretion.
I would agree with that, yes, Your Honor.
Well, then why doesn't that same standard apply to the decision of the court to raise it sua sponte?
Because in this case, you have an express concession, and so this court has said, and other courts have said, that when you have an express concession, it's error to override that concession and impose the defense sua sponte. The court should instead assume that the concession is valid and that refusal to honor it is an abuse of discretion. You don't want to strip.
Were those cases of a miscalculation on the part of the state? The judge's view was that the state had miscalculated under 11th Amendment, under 11th Circuit precedent.
Well, Your Honor, most of those cases involved other issues like exhaustion and procedural default, where the state later came back and said we were mistaken that they exhausted or we were mistaken that they didn't procedurally default this claim. So it's a similar mistake claim, but nonetheless, the state affirmatively pleaded the opposite of either exhaustion, procedural default, or limitations, and the court held them to that.
So you'd say it'd be okay if the state didn't expressly concede the statute of limitations point?
Possibly. But again, I think if you use the analysis of the civil rules that applies here by virtue of Civil Rule 81 and Habeas Rule 11, that it's error. Our first position is that it's error to override the forfeiture.
That's what I thought your position was.
Yes, except in exceptional
circumstances. This is a fallback position.
Yes, that's correct. And then our second fallback position is that even if your honors agree that the court has discretion to override the express waiver, that there's at least a discretionary analysis that has to apply under Civil Rule 15 that's coupled with a presumption against sua sponte dismissal that the 11th Circuit didn't apply here.
Why, just out of curiosity, I'm not familiar with the actual practice in a lot of civil cases, but when somebody, let's say the defendant in an ordinary tort case, forgets to put in the statute of limitations or something, the case is all tried and finished, at the very end he says, oh, my God, and now he goes in and asks to amend it under Rule 15. Do judges normally say fine?
No, they normally say no, because the case has gone on down the road on another theory, and it's prejudicial to the parties, and it has wasted the court's judicial resources
here,
to bring it up.
Nothing happened.
The
answer was put in, and then there were no further proceedings. Nothing else went on in the court.
Well,
quite different. I don't know any judge that would allow a defendant after the trial is over to raise the statute of limitations, but up front, a different situation.
Well, we disagree that this was up front, Your Honor. The answer in a habeas corpus case is, of course, heavily deals with the merits, as it did in this case. And then Mr. Day replied, and as the state's amicus brief points out, that's all that usually happens in most habeas corpus cases. So we were near the end of the proceeding, if you think of the run-of-the-mind habeas corpus case. And also, speaking of run-of-the-mind habeas corpus cases, this is a very rare instance. There are lots of procedures for courts to vindicate the interest that the state describes in comity, finality, and federalism, whether ordering the state to file a motion to dismiss under Rule 4, which we submit would be the proper procedure, or if the state fails to raise it in its answer, in certain circumstances, inviting them to file a motion to amend under Rule 15. That takes care of these interests in the run-of-the-mind case. There's no need to vindicate those interests in this case by creating an exception to the rules. This court has said in Lonchar and in Carlisle that where there are civil rules that deal with and habeas rules that deal with how these things happen, the court cannot use its inherent powers to circumvent those rules, and we submit that that's exactly what the court did here. Now, in addition, I'd like to point the court to New York versus Hill, which is not cited in our briefs, but can be found at 528 U.S. at 114-15 and also 118 on this express waiver issue. And this is a case where the court recognized exactly the point that we make here, you don't always have to show intentional relinquishment of a known right for that to be the standard for waiver. It depends on the right at issue. There, it was an International Agreement on Detainers Act case, and the court held that the defendant's assent to delay waived the time limitation of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers Act, expressly waived it. And that's our position here, is that the state's affirmative pleading of timeliness is an express waiver. In addition, the state certainly couldn't prevail under the Brady versus U.S. standard that applies to plea agreements for saying that its concession was not knowing. There's no suggestion here that the state was misled. There's no suggestion that they didn't have all the information they needed to make the calculation. And Brady says that simply misapprehending a factor, a relevant factor in the analysis, is not enough. And that's at 397 U.S. at page 757. In addition, the state makes an argument about policies beyond the concerns of the parties and that the state — that those should be vindicated in this case. But I'd like to point out that this Court has not adopted the beyond the concerns of the parties test. Rather, it's acknowledged that Congress entrusts even important public policies like comity, finality, and federalism to the adversary process. And thus, their and even private rights that benefit society can be waived, in Christiansburg Garment, for example. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Keis.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the District Court's sua sponte action here was consistent with AEDPA and the habeas rules. It was consistent with this Court's habeas jurisprudence, and it was consistent with the purpose behind and not prohibited by Federal Rules 8 and 12. This case is not about the state's waiver, and we would agree that with Justice Scalia that the waiver is not the beginning and end of it. We're not conceding that the state, in fact, waived it here, but we're saying that that's not essential to the answer to this question because it's not the beginning and the end of the analysis. This case is also not about, as the petitioner alleges in the brief and makes inference on the 11th Circuit's opinion, about obligating courts to act in all circumstances. This case is about the proper exercise of discretion. And what we're really asking this Court to do is really three things: to acknowledge again that this authority exists, to say that this is when the Court may exercise that authority under the circumstances presented by this case, and then thirdly, that this is how the Court goes about exercising this authority by providing notice, an opportunity to be heard, and conducting an analysis of prejudice.
Do you think the Court must?
No, Your Honor.
Well, don't you think that's what this Court thought? And if so, shouldn't we perhaps send it back to see whether, if the Court knew that it had discretion, it would have done this?
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that that's what the 11th Circuit thought. I think that is an interpretation of the 11th Circuit's language. However, I think that where the phrase that counsel pointed to in the opinion on page 5A, referencing obligation, I believe that the Court there is referring to specifically under Rule 4 that the Court has this obligation. I think it's because it's in that discussion that the Court is talking about the obligation. And I would submit that indeed under Rule 4, in response, I believe, to a point Justice Kennedy raised, I would say that under Rule 4, I think it is an obligation. I think what Rule 4 is a reflection of Congress — of the rule advising the Court that you must exercise this authority that you already have at this particular time. This is the time when you need to be looking for these
yes,
things.
Yes, but Mr. Pies, Mr. Busby told us that the reference was in the following paragraph, and it is the sentence, a federal court that sits in collateral review of a criminal judgment of a state court has an obligation to enforce the federal statute of limitations. That's the sentence that suggests that the Court of Appeals thought that there was an obligation of the district court to raise the statute of limitations on its own motion.
Your Honor, and I was referring to that sentence, and perhaps I wasn't clear, but I would say that they are still talking about Rule 4. But even if they're not talking about Rule 4, even if, in fact, this Court believes that the circuit court's analysis is flawed, then we must keep in mind that this Court is reviewing judgments, not opinions. And this Court could easily do what it did in Gonzales, which is, even though the analysis is not consistent with what this Court — and, frankly, if the Court takes that view with what we're asking the Court to do here, but you can nevertheless affirm the judgment, because the district court did, in fact, get it right.
What would you say, assuming that we're beyond Rule 4, what would you say simply to a rule that said, yes, we recognize that there remains a discretion — not an obligation, but a discretion on the part of the court to raise this. But just as a general rule, judicial efficiency is better served by avoiding the use of discretion unless the state, in fact, raises the limitations issue itself. The courts have a lot of things to do, and they shouldn't be spending their time canvassing pleadings to see whether there might be an issue that the state missed, so that in the absence of some extraordinary circumstance, it would be an abuse of discretion to exercise it as the circuit suggests it should have been exercised here. What would you say to that position?
I would say respectfully, Your Honor, that that is somewhat inconsistent, if not entirely inconsistent, with what this Court said in Granberry and Kaspari, dealing with the same sort of raising of affirmative defenses. From that standpoint, from a procedural standpoint, I would say that Granberry and Kaspari are procedurally indistinct in that this Court said that it is appropriate in these circumstances for the Court to look at affirmative defenses. Obviously, they have substantive differences, which counsel has pointed out. But from a procedural standpoint, were the petitioner to prevail here, I would think this Court needs to recede procedurally from Granberry and Kaspari. Because
what then would be the significance here of the fact that the state conceded that there was no limitations problem in a case like that? Wouldn't it be a good rule to avoid judicial inquiry?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the state's concession, as Justice Scalia pointed out, is not the beginning and end of it in the first instance. Secondly,
no, but it bears on the exercise of discretion.
Yes, Your Honor, it does. And we would agree that it bears on the exercise of discretion. And in a circumstance such as this one, where the attachments, the record itself, indicated that there was a discrepancy between the position the state was taking and what the record actually reflected, it was appropriate for the district court to raise the issue and then consider the interests of the parties. If the district court had been presented simply with nothing in the record, just a blanket statement by Florida that we concede and there was nothing to raise the question, then we would say that it's not appropriate for the court to simply pull issues out of the sky.
That would be an abuse.
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that it would be an abuse.
District judges can't comment on the cases, and they suddenly raise something, curious about something, and lo and behold, it becomes the subject of an amendment.
Well,
it's
just
a violation of — I mean, what I'm driving at is I don't really understand Rule 15 thoroughly because I'm not a trial lawyer. And why do we have to decide every matter? Why don't we let the district judge free to run his trial and just say, hey, we don't want to proliferate law. It's complicated enough already. Let's leave it to Rule 15, whatever that might be.
I think leaving it to Rule 15 is one way to do it, and doing it in these particular cases is another way, giving the court's discretion to raise
it. But the other way means we're now going to have a new area of law. The new area of law consists of habeas law involving what is the equivalent of an amendment suggested by the judge to bring up a statute. That would be good, because West would then have five more pages with a new keynote, and there would be more for lawyers to look up. Whereas if you just say Rule 15, it's finished.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe this Court's already done that, though, in Granberry and Kaspari. I mean, that's what you've already said, is that that habeas is different. And I think it's important to point out, we're not asking for a different construction of Rules 8 and 12. We're asking this Court to apply the same exception that is applied in the extraordinary case. The petitioner takes the position, and the petitioner is alone in this contention, that ordinarily means never. Even the law professor amici don't take that position, and there is not a case that we have been able to locate in the country that says that ordinarily means never, that
would
the
you
ordinary
say it means it's hardly ever. I mean, we do follow the principle of party presentation, and judges are not supposed to be intruding issues on their own. They are supposed to follow the party's presentation. So would this be if it's not never, would it be at least hardly ever that it's appropriate for a judge to interject an affirmative defense on his own motion?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that it is hardly ever, and that's what we're dealing with here. It's what the Court was dealing with in Granberry and Kaspari. These limited circumstances where the interests transcend the interests of just the parties before the Court, and where it is, from a review of the record, as district judges do every day, looking at the record and identifying issues, and to avoid the sort of conundrum that's presented by the petitioner agreeing that the district judge could simply look at the state and as Justice Scalia said, wink, wink, it's okay for you to raise this issue now, to avoid the
roundabout that is occasioned by that. If it is in fact permissible in these circumstances for the district court to raise the issue, then doing it the way the court did it here and the way that it was approved in Bendolph and the way that we believe the 11th Circuit approved it is entirely appropriate because it's consistent with what this court said in its habeas jurisprudence.
What if Congress wanted to leave it to the state to waive the statute of limitations provision? How could it have made that clear? I mean, I would have thought that if they made it a statute of limitations provision instead of a jurisdictional provision, I mean, they could have said, you know, no jurisdiction if it's filed beyond a certain date, and we mean it. But it put it as a statute of limitation, which normally is waivable. And I would think that is an indication that Congress thought, really, if the state thinks that in this particular case we shouldn't hew to the technicality of the statute of limitation, the state ought to be able to waive it.
And I think that's why it is set up the way it is, Your Honor, but it's just that the waiver is not the beginning and end of it. For example, where the state might wish to waive the statute of limitations and simply move to the merits would be in a situation where there might be some complex argument over equitable tolling and where the merits are relatively straightforward. Rather than spending the court's time and the resources involved in litigating over equitable tolling, the state might simply say, we realize that there is this technicality here, but we're going to get to the merits because otherwise we're going to spend an inordinate amount of time litigating.
It's always a technicality. What you're saying is the only time that the state can do that is when the answer to the statute of limitations is unclear. And I'm saying sometimes the state may say the answer is clear, but doggone it, this is just too picky, too technical in this particular case.
And Your Honor, our test allows for that as well. It's up to the district court to decide whether in that particular case the circumstances require the application. There is some discretion. I don't think that the state
would it always be an abuse of discretion for the district court to do this if the state wanted to reach the merits?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because it would depend on why the state wanted to reach the merits. Perhaps the state was engaging in some sort of gaming of the system, as petitioner alleges could happen. If there was, in fact, some actual sandbagging going on where the state is holding this issue in reserve as a strategic matter, and the district court simply says, no, we're not going to allow that. And it would really be the same analysis under Rule 15. If the court were to have sandbagged, so to speak, under Rule 15 and waited to file a late amendment, the court would engage in the same analysis. The court would say, well, wait, do I really want to permit the state now?
There's no question of put aside a sandbagging case. There's no question of sandbagging, and the state just wants to litigate on the merits rather than on the statute of limitations.
It would not always be an abuse of discretion.
In other words, can they have it? Would it be an abuse of discretion in an express waiver case as opposed to a forfeiture case?
I don't think that you could say in all circumstances, no, Your Honor. It would not be an abuse of discretion in all circumstances, but I do think the district court needs to factor in the interests of the state and the reasons why the state is willing to proceed forward. And if the state, for example, is, as I believe an example was given by the court, that the state believes that, well, perhaps it's appropriate to waive the statute here or to not rely on the statute here because of something maybe we have done or that the petitioner didn't miss the deadline by a certain period of time, and we think that in this particular case it's all right to reach those merits. So I don't think we should say that it's always an abuse of discretion, but I think we need to leave it to district courts to make that determination, just as this court did in Granberry and Caspari. This court gave district courts that discretion because these are the types of cases where that discretion is appropriate. This court's already identified that in habeas cases we are to treat Rules 8 and 12 as the exception being applied.
I thought in Granberry the court gave the Court of Appeals that discretion because the point had been missed in the district court, been missed by everybody until the Court of Appeals.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, this court did give the Court of Appeals that discretion, but even more so then we would give the district court that discretion, because why should we wait for the process to get all the way to the Court of Appeals? If this court is going to say it's appropriate for the Court of Appeals to look at an affirmative defense, then certainly in keeping with that reasoning, it would be appropriate for a district court to raise it before we've gone through the entire process of litigation in the district court and then getting ourselves to the Court of Appeals.
You acknowledge at least this much, or am I incorrect? And it's important for me to know that. You acknowledge at least this much, that if we read this opinion, as you do not, to be saying that the court must do this, so that the court was not really considering all factors in the exercise of its discretion, we would have to remand.
No, Your Honor, I would not, and I'll tell you why I would not. It's because
just as in Gonzales, the court is not reviewing the opinion. The court is reviewing the judgment. And the judgment is correct.
Why would you deal with that hypothetical when the 11th Circuit, in all fairness, said, we join the 2nd, 4th, 5th, and 9th Circuit and rule that, even though the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, the district court may review the timeliness of the 2254? That's what the question that the court thought it was deciding.
I would agree that the court thought it was deciding discretion, but I was responding to what I thought was Justice Scalia's question about what if this court does not agree with that. If this court believes that the 11th Circuit, in fact, was applying an obligation rule, a mandatory rule, then it would require remand. And what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that it would not, because the district court applied the appropriate test. In the first instance, I would say that the 11th Circuit did not, in fact, apply that test, did not believe that it was obligated to. But if this court were to disagree, as Justice Scalia has presented the hypothetical, then I would say that the district court did, in fact, apply the correct test. The district court, as noted on page 8A of the petition appendix, the footnote in the magistrate's report and recommendation cites Jackson, the 11th Circuit case, which stands for the discretionary proposition, and indicates specifically that it is relying on a discretionary test. And so the district court in this case, in fact, applied the test that we are advocating and frankly, got it right. The district court applied discretion, raised the issue, provided a notice and an opportunity to be heard, conducted the analysis of prejudice — there was no prejudice in this case and ruled on that basis. And that ruling was consistent with this court's habeas jurisprudence, and it was consistent with AEDPA and with the habeas rules.
Why doesn't your position on the underlying merits of the timeliness question create an incentive for every habeas petitioner to file a cert petition?
I'm not sure I follow your —
Well, you question. Only get the extra 90 days if you actually file under your explanation for why this cert petition is — why this habeas petition is untimely. In other words, if this individual had filed a cert petition with us, his petition, his habeas petition, would be timely. And he's only going to get the extra period, as I understand your position on the timeliness, if he files a cert petition.
I understand our position to be that they do not get the 90 days post-conviction, and if that is misstated in our brief, but I certainly we're not attempting to encourage the filing of cert petitions by habeas petitioners, and we believe the statute provides for the 90 days post-direct review, but not after following state post-conviction. Once the state post-conviction proceedings are no longer pending, meaning that they are completed for state purposes, not including the 90 days, right, that's when they terminate. That is our position.
Even if they file a cert petition?
Yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't that put them in the position of sometimes having to file the habeas petition while the cert petition is still pending if they file one?
Yes, Your Honor, it might. It does present that conundrum. Mm-hmm. But that's what the statute provides. That is the way the statute has provided for it, and we think that interpretation is consistent because there certainly, as was referenced in the first oral argument, there is some expectation that the court might grant certiorari, but it's not in the likely case. And so to suspend the congressional purpose of moving these cases through the system on the chance that the 1 in 1,000 or perhaps more than 1 in 1,000 case is granted certiorari would not be an appropriate process to utilize, and I think the circuit courts bear that out. The opinions of all but one of the circuits bear that.
Is there a conflict on the circuits on that point? I don't know.
Your Honor, one circuit. 10 of the circuits go in the direction that we advocate, and Abella, the Sixth Circuit case that is cited, I believe, by the petitioner, moves in the other direction, and it is only recently that they have done that. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hallward-Driemeier, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, there is nothing in either the habeas rules or the federal rules of civil procedure that deprives the district court of its authority sua sponte to recognize the untimeliness of a habeas petition. To the contrary, to the extent the rules speak to the issue at all, they confirm that in light of the significant social costs of federal review of state court convictions, the federal courts have a unique responsibility to weed out unmeritorious claims and to enforce the limitations on habeas review. Rule 4 imposes an obligation on the court to dismiss unmeritorious petitions without even calling for an answer by the state. Now, Rule 4 is not applicable here, but the absence of an obligation to note the deficiency sua sponte does not connote a prohibition on acting sua sponte. Rather, it suggests that it lies in the court's discretion. That is exactly how this court addressed similar question in Granberry, where it rejected the two extremes. One, recognizing the limitation as jurisdictional, that the court was obligated to raise it sua sponte, but also rejecting the opposite extreme, that the court was prohibited to address an issue that had not been preserved in the district court.
Why though, would we have a special rule in this respect for habeas cases? Same question I've had throughout. Treat it like any other civil case.
It's not really a special rule that we're advocating.
All right. If it's not a special rule, then the answer to this is just say no. You don't have to raise it sua sponte. Moreover, you cannot raise it sua sponte except in exceptional circumstances. Cite the three cases that said that. And as far as you're suggesting it to people, you can do it just as much as you do in any other civil case, no special rule. If they want to move to amend, fine. End of case. We did it in a paragraph.
The relevant analogy in the civil context is not to what a court would do with a statute of limitations defense in the civil context. It is to what would the court do with respect to an affirmative defense that, like the habeas limitations, implicates broader social interests.
Well, same with strike suits, you know. There are a lot of class action strike suits and so forth that at least one group of people think are terrible and the other group think are great. You say, well, we're going to have a special thing here for amendments and strike suits. Have a special amendment for some, you know, why proliferate law?
Well, the court recognized Arizona v. California is an example of the broader social interests that are implicated by the affirmative defense of res judicata. And the court noted in Arizona versus California that it would be appropriate for the court to raise that defense sua sponte. And, of course, Plout versus Spendthrift Farm says the same thing.
Not generally. Statute of limitations, like res judicata, they are 8C affirmative defenses, and preclusion doctrine is for the party to waive or not. It's like the statute of limitations. I don't think there's any rule that says a judge in the run-of-the-mind case acts properly by interjecting preclusion into a case where no party has raised it.
Well, our point is that it is a matter for the court's discretion. And there may well be circumstances where it would be an abuse of discretion to interject a timeliness objection. For example, if the case had gone on for years and a trial had been held, as Your Honor suggested in the question earlier, that might well be an abuse of discretion. But it would not. For example, take the case where the district court had dismissed at the outset on the merits, and it went up to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said, you know, that merits issue is a very difficult one, and in fact, we think we might have to remand for an evidentiary hearing on that issue. But you know, this case was untimely filed. We can dispose of it on that basis, and we can save all of those judicial and party resources by addressing that issue now. We think that would be an appropriate exercise of the court's discretion. Here, as Your Honor noted earlier, this was the first thing that happened in the district court after the filing of the petition, the answer, and the reply. There was no waste of judicial resources by the fact that it was raised sua sponte by the court in the first thing that the court did after that briefing. There was no prejudice to the petitioner because it was omitted from the state's responsive pleading. There is, as the court said in Granberry, the failure to plead it perhaps waives the state's opportunity to insist on the defense. The state, because it said in its answer here erroneously that the petition was timely filed, or if it had said nothing, would have waived its opportunity to stand on and insist on that defense. But it is not an absolute forfeiture. It does not bar the party from suggesting at a later time we would like to amend, or in this case, the court to note it sua sponte. The court did here, of course, give the petitioner every opportunity.
Excuse me. From what you just said, I take it that means that even when the state is unwilling to change its mind and says, no, we would still prefer not to assert the defense, you would allow the court to impose it.
We believe that the court is not absolutely limited by the defense.
The answer is yes.
Yes. Yes. The court is not absolutely limited by the affirmative defenses asserted by the state. And that is perhaps most easily seen with respect to affirmative defenses such as failure to exhaust, non-retroactivity. If the court was going to have to assess a brand new constitutional claim that the habeas petitioner
was asserting. But with respect to some of those, of course, AEDPA specifically promulgates new rules about when they're waived and not, and Congress hasn't done that with respect to the statute of limitations.
That's right. And obviously, as the state suggested, if the state didn't want to stand on the statute of limitations defense because, for example, it was particularly messy, there was going to be a lot of litigation about equitable tolling, it would be inappropriate for the court to insist on litigating that issue. But if, for example, the state said, well, you know, if we didn't stand on this defense, instead this petitioner would go back to the state court, and the state's courts are going to be very hospitable to this claim. We think you're more likely to deny relief, so we'd rather have it litigated here. It would be inappropriate for the state to try to force the federal court to litigate that issue instead of the state court. These are all fact-specific, case-specific considerations, and that's what the court did in Granberry. It remanded, after setting aside both extreme positions, it remanded to the Court of Appeals for a case-specific application of discretion. As to the question whether the 11th Circuit here believed that there was an absolute obligation, I think that it's relevant to note that although there was one point at which it said the court was obligated to enforce the statute of limitations. And, of course, that's true if the state has preserved the defense. There were three other points in the Court of Appeals opinion where it used discretionary or non-mandatory language. For example, at Petition Appendix 4A, the court said that the district court may dismiss. At the Petition Appendix 5A, said that the state's failure to raise does not bar the court from acting sua sponte. Again, at Petition Appendix 6A, the state's concession, quote, does not compromise the authority of the district court. All of those are phrased in more permissive language.
But, of course, may is embraced within must. If you must, you may.
Well, perhaps the even most clear indication of what the Court of Appeals viewed this is its citation to Jackson. As an application of Jackson. And in Jackson, there is no question, because Jackson said, quote, the district court possessed the discretion to raise sua sponte. And the magistrate judge, as the state's counsel mentioned in footnote 1 of its opinion, cites that same standard and makes clear that it's raising this as a matter of its discretion. So remand for the exercise of discretion would be serve no purpose in this case. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Busby, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to begin by addressing the must versus may issue that counsel discussed. For the reasons I mentioned, I think the better reading of the 11th Circuit's opinion is that there was an obligation and that the most clear indication of that is its distinction of Esslinger, which expressly applied a Granberry-type analysis. But even if the court believes that the 11th Circuit was only saying may and that the district court was only saying may and recognized that it had discretion, and there is a footnote in the magistrate's opinion that cites to Jackson that says we have discretion, I would submit that if you read Jackson, it's a standardless discretion. There are no factors anywhere in Jackson of the type that this court discussed in Granberry. And there's no indication that the magistrate judge considered any of those factors. There's no indication that the 11th Circuit considered any of those factors. And it's certainly an abuse of discretion for a court to apply the wrong legal standard or fail to consider the relevant factors that channel that discretion. And so our position is that because the factors under Rule 15 and the other factors in our brief were not applied, that a remand at a minimum is appropriate in this case. Also, I'd like to speak to Granbury and Kaspari. Again, those involved exhaustion and non-retroactivity, and I submit that it's not correct to characterize those two doctrines as affirmative defenses. Rather, the way that Congress codified them is as substantive limits on relief, unlike limitations, which it just said period of limitations, which as the commonly accepted meaning is an affirmative defense. And so that makes those very different from an affirmative defense in terms of sua sponte consideration. Also, both exhaustion and non-retroactivity are unique to habeas. They're not mentioned anywhere in Rules 8 and 12, whereas limitations, of course, is mentioned explicitly. And so our position is that Rule 8 and 12, not necessarily always, but at least in all but extraordinary cases, would prevent the judge from raising this sua sponte. Also, I would say that the rules that we rely on don't deprive the court of sua sponte authority. They channel that authority. Under Rule 4, they can plead it, or the court can make a motion to dismiss, order the state to make a motion to dismiss based on limitations under habeas Rule 4. They can plead it in their answer under habeas Rule 5 and Civil Rules 8 and 12, or they can amend their answer under Civil Rule 15. That's the way the drafters of the rules wanted them to do this, and Lonchar and Carlisle say they cannot that a judge cannot use his sua sponte power to circumvent the requirements of those rules. Finally, I'd like to mention that the statutes of limitations in civil cases also implicate broader social interests, and some of them we've discussed in our brief, and even more so because there are lots of protections in AEDPA cases that don't apply in civil cases. There are presumptions of correctness and those sorts of things, but courts in civil cases nonetheless say that statutes of limitations can be waived, and the result should be no different here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.